All right, welcome to all of you. And we're going to be looking at today the comparing. What we're going to be basically doing is three things today. Number one is we're going to be looking at, we're going to be looking at the at what is the purpose of apologetics? What is the real purpose of that? And why it's centered in history. And then we're going to jump off from that to looking at comparing the life of Jesus with the life of Alexander the Great, and to show how have really good evidence for what it says in the New Testament that Jesus did is really what he said and did. And so we're going to look at by comparing somebody that nobody questions whether Alexander the Great really conquered Persia and all those things, but everybody wants to question whether Jesus rose from the dead. And we're going to compare those and see how they stack up between one another. So before we begin, let's have a word of prayer, and then we're going to jump into these materials today. God, we thank you so much for the day you give to us. I thank you for each person that you brought here. I praise you that you brought them here. And I recognize that everybody is here for a purpose. And we don't know what the purpose sometimes that you bring this group, this gathering together. But I pray that you will help each person see your purpose in this, and that they will bring glory to you through the time that you've brought them here today, that there would be just an awareness of the greatness, the majesty, the grandeur of what you've done in Jesus Christ. And we ask these things in your name. Amen. All right, my name is Timothy Paul Jones, and I teach here at Southern Seminary. And that's who I am. And I just lost my connection between my phone and that right there. And so we'll go ahead and see if we can make this work better. Again, right there. So let me just put a pause on everything for just a moment while we get our technical parts of this worked out, and then we will resume in just a second. There we go. See if we get that. There we go. All right. And trying new tech. Has anybody else tried to use your iPhone to control that right there? And so if I were in your shoes at your age, what I'd be trying to do is now I'd be trying to figure out, is there some way I can control his slideshow and do something really wild? That's what I would seriously be doing at this point if I were your age at this time. This is my family, my wife, Rayanne, daughters, Hannah and Skylar, and my daughter is 16 years old, my oldest one, and just had her first accident yesterday in the vehicle, doing damage to our vehicle. Has anybody else done this in here? Okay. You've done this to your parents. Okay. So we had our first experience of that yesterday with our 16-year-old. And so that's what we're in the midst of. I write several books on apologetics and on history. Misquoting Truth, Christian History Made Easy are the things I've done on apologetics and history. That's one of the areas that is kind of my focus and what I focus on, as well as family ministry in the areas that I teach. So what I want us to do is, as I said, look at some of these different, I'm having problems with my iPad right here. Maybe some of you are trying to do this. I don't know. But anyway, so we'll go ahead and pull this up. What I want you to do is turn to your Bibles. We're going to be looking at this in a little bit at 1 Corinthians chapter 15. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. We'll dispense with the iPhone on this, and we'll do it this way. I want us to look at, in some different areas of Scripture, what is apologetics? What is apologetics? I want us to look at just exactly what we mean when we say that. You've probably heard that already during the time you've been here, the term apologetics, and we want to learn what that means. Now, apologetics is not learning to apologize well. So if you have to go in somewhere and you're thinking, okay, apologetics is about learning to apologize well, that's not what it is. What apologetics has to do with, it comes from a Greek word, apologia. You know, what an apologia was in ancient law courts was your answer to the accusations. So when we think about apologetics, what we're thinking about is your answer to accusations that are leveled against the Christian faith. But it's really important that we recognize what we're exactly doing in that. So it was a defense, it was a response to what was called the categoria in the Roman law court. But it's important that we recognize why we do apologetics. How many of you have friends that bring up charges against the Christian faith? You got people that, all over the place. You got people who are attacking the Christian faith. What apologetics is about giving a good defense or a good reason back when they do that. That's what we're all about. That's what this whole conference is about, is helping us to be able to do that, to give a response back when we are accused in some way in terms of our faith. Now, it's used in a couple of different ways in the New Testament. One of them is like this legal speech, okay, that we've talked about here, this legal speech to defend against legal charges. But the other way that it's used in the New Testament is testimony to the integrity of the gospel. And that's what I want you to be able to do. That's what I want you, as a result of having been here today, I want you to be able to give testimony that gives witness to the integrity of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, what I say when I'm talking about the gospel is about the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, by which God is making the world right. He's making the world right and new through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. I want you to be able to respond adequately to people when they give charges. But here's the fact that, and this is with me, this is with any of us, that sometimes we get mixed up about the real goal of apologetics. And sometimes we get the idea that it's to prove me right. And sometimes when you have somebody attack your faith, one of the things that you do and that I feel like doing as well is I feel like kind of trying to defend me. It becomes about me. You feel that upsetness, that frustration, that anger rising in you, that they're attacking something that you believe, and you want to attack back. You want to prove yourself right in that. But that's not the goal. The goal is not to prove yourself right. It's not even to prove that Christians are right. That's not the goal. The goal is not even to cause people to become Christians. Because you can't do that in your power, and neither can I. That's a God thing. So the goal of apologetics is not to prove yourself right. So remember that when you're trying to defend your faith. Remember that when somebody attacks your faith, your goal is not to prove you right. It's not about you, and it's not about me. The goal is not to prove Christians right, and the goal is not to cause people to become Christians. Rather, the goal is, this is what I want us to see in this, the goal of apologetics is to testify faithfully to the coherence and integrity. That means it fits together of the gospel of Jesus Christ in a world that's hostile to that message. You can't make people become Christians. And if you make your goal to prove yourself right, you're just going to harden people to the message. And you're going to raise just a pride and arrogance in yourself, even if you prove right. What you want to do is to testify to the coherence and the integrity of the gospel in a world that is hostile to that message. I want you to understand that, because that kind of frames everything else that we're going to do. It's so crucial that we understand that it's not about me being right. It's not about my church being right. It's not even about getting this person to agree with me about Jesus. It's about, did I testify faithfully to the truth about the gospel? That's what it's all about, every part of it. So I want us to move from that, thinking about now the goal of apologetics, to why do we even care about apologetics? Why does it matter? There are two big reasons. One of them for the believer, one of them for the unbeliever. And those reasons are simple. Why study apologetics? We look at apologetics because it is one means that God uses to bring unbelievers to faith in Jesus. Do you realize when you testify faithfully to the coherence and the truth and the integrity of the gospel, that God can use that as one of the means by which He brings somebody to the faith in Jesus Christ? In other words, it's God uses that. But it also helps you. It helps you because it awakens you as a believer. It awakens your mind to the beauty of what God's done in Christ. If you see that it's not just about my feelings about Jesus, it's not just about what my mom and dad have told me, but God really did something in history through Jesus, that awakens your mind to the beauty and the wonder and the majesty of what God has done in Jesus Christ. Now, part of what I want, why I'm passionate about this, is that when I was in the stage of life that you're in, I never thought about my faith. I never thought about why it's really true. I was in a Christian school. I was in a context where nobody was really questioning this, and I just wasn't thinking about how do I know it's true. Then I hit college. And in my first year of college, and this was in a Bible college, this wasn't where somebody was really attacking the faith, but I got so many things that I had never heard before that it just shook my faith to the core. It really did, because I'd never thought about it. I never thought about it at all. I heard that there were pagan parallels to the New Testament. I heard that there were that I had been always told and had been raised believing that the King James Version was pretty much dropped straight out of heaven in black leather binding, okay? That was the only Bible, and it had pretty much come straight to us. That's how I was raised. And I hit college and found out that, you know what? Not even one of all the thousands of manuscripts of the New Testament agrees word for word with any of the others. And from what I had believed before, that shook my faith. That absolutely rattled my faith. And I worked in the libraries to work my way through college. And I remember just digging through books, trying to find different things. And I remember just breaking down in tears in the back of the library because I kept getting all these ideas, and I'd never thought about it before. I want you to think about it now. I want you to think about, why do I believe what I believe now? Because over and over I speak at college campuses and run across students who have been raised in the church but never have thought about why they believe what they believe. They've never thought about it. And because of that, they're vulnerable to being shaken in their faith, not because there's not a good foundation for their faith, but just because no one's helped them to think about what they believe. And so that's what I want us to see in this, is that it helps us to be a witness to unbelievers, but it helps us also for us to testify faithfully and to see the beauty, the majesty, the wonder of what God has done in and through Jesus Christ. Now, when we're approaching apologetics, here's something I think is really important for in your discussions and things like this. You think about that there are four parts to God's story. God created a good world, okay? That world fell into sin. God has redeemed the world through Jesus Christ, and God has promised at the end of time to bring about a new creation. Those are the four parts of God's story. Now, I do this with at Sojourn with the children there, and we do it this way. This is how even the 4 and 5-year-olds remember this way. We say that God made the world good, sin made the world groan. Jesus broke the power of sin so God can make the world new. That's what we do there. Now, I'm not going to make you do this, but I do this with the 4 and 5-year-olds at Sojourn, so they know the four movements of God's story right here. Even before they go to school, they know this. They know these movements of God's story. But what I want us to see in this is, as we look at the movements of God's story, what matters most in apologetics? I want us to think through here. We can get caught up in a lot of issues about creation, can't we? There's a lot of discussions on that. A lot of arguments we can have about that. But do you know, whatever your view of how and when God created the earth, you can argue somebody all the way down, and you can, at the end of that, you can convince them of the fact of whatever it is that you believe about creation. And do you know what? That person is still lost. They still don't know Jesus. It's not that that's a bad discussion to have, but you can convince them of what you believe in that, but they still are lost. People have questions at times about the fall, about why is there sin in the world? Why does God let bad things happen? And you may be able to argue all the way through with somebody and go all the way to the point of convincing them that if there's evil allowed in the world, it's for a good reason and that God is still good. But at the end of that, they're still lost. They're still lost. You may have a particular view of the end of time, how God will bring about the end of time, and when God will do that, and about what are the signs that point to that. And you might be able to convince somebody of that, but do you know what? If you convince them of all of those things, they're still lost. So what matters most when you're talking to somebody about your faith? See, it's so easy to get caught up in these other parts, but without that one part, the redemption, the other parts don't make sense. Or at least you can't see the full measure of what they mean to us. And so what I want to encourage you to do, and the reason we're looking at some of the specifics about the life of Jesus we're going to, is because I want you, every time you talk to somebody about your faith, that you try to run straight for the cross and the empty tomb. You run straight for that. Take whatever, if they want to talk about creation, you can talk about, you know what, there's this different views, but you know what, I want to run straight to and talk about how God started a new creation, how he broke the power of sin, and how he demonstrated that through the empty tomb of Jesus Christ. We can talk about the other later, but I want to talk to you about the empty tomb. If you say about the problem of evil in the world and why that is, then rather than getting caught up in all the ins and outs of that, to say, you know what matters most is that on the cross, Jesus took on himself the weight of the evil and the sin of this world. He took it on himself. Let's talk about the cross and the empty tomb. And when you want to talk, somebody wants to talk about how is time going to end? What about the Mayan calendar? All those things like that. If somebody wants to talk about stuff like that, rather than getting caught up in that, talk about how, do you know how and why God made the promise of making the world new? He demonstrated that by raising Jesus from the dead. And that Jesus being raised from the dead pointed forward to the end of time. Let me talk to you about the resurrection of Jesus. Whatever you do, run as fast as you can to the death and the resurrection of Jesus. Don't get caught up in all the other stuff. Run as fast as you can, because here's what happens often when you get caught up in all the other stuff. Then eventually somebody comes up with a question you just can't answer, because it becomes a game of, well, what about this in the Bible? What about this in the Bible? What about this? What about this? What about this? What about this? And no matter if you've got a PhD in this, eventually somebody asks a question you don't know. But if you run straight to one thing every time, you say, I want to tell you about the cross and the empty tomb. That is the thing that matters most. So I want us to understand that, to see that, to believe that. Because the historical reality of the cross and the empty tomb stand at the center of everything in the Christian faith. They stand at the center of everything. But that brings us to our crucial question for today. How do we know what happened in the past? How do we know? Now, you already know the answer to this question, because I can ask you a question and you will reveal exactly the right standards for this, because I'll ask you one question, and it's a very religious question. It's, how do you know what you ate for lunch yesterday? Tell me, give me feedback on this. How do you know what you, I'm sorry? You were there, okay. Now, has there ever been something you've done? I'm going to push back with all of you on this. Is there anything you've done that you've ever lied about within the next 24 hours? Okay. So it could be that you're lying about that. It could be that you're saying a certain thing, okay. But that's one witness. That's one testimony. I was there, okay. What else? Give me some other reason. How do you know what you ate for lunch yesterday? If this became a big issue, how would you determine what you ate? How would you determine it?
My family was there.
Oh. Three other people were there. Multiple witnesses, huh? Multiple witnesses. What else? So we've got personal witness, multiple witness. How else would you figure this out? A receipt, a written record. Wouldn't you? You'd have a written record. Now, could somebody forge a receipt? It's possible, isn't it? It's possible. Could your family, those three family members, could they be lying about this? They could. But if we have a written record and three witnesses and a personal witness, that starts to make you think about, maybe you really did have anchovy pizza yesterday for lunch, or whatever it was that you had, okay? What else? What are some other reasons? What are some other ways? If you were trying to establish what you ate yesterday for lunch, what are some other evidences you would call on?
The effects, okay?
Okay. Yeah, Taco Bell, and people were riding with me in the van, and man, let me tell you about it, okay? All right, there we go. So the effect of it on people, okay? So you're right, the effect of it on other people, all right? What else would it be?
seeing what food was missing. So going back and seeing in that place, what is the evidence there that what was missing? Now you guys have hit most of these already. You guys are as smart as most professional historians already. You just don't know that you are yet, okay? You just don't know it yet because there are standard ways that you find out whether something really happened or not. How do I determine what happened in the past? One of them is multiple eyewitnesses, all right? Now, can multiple eyewitnesses lie? Yeah, they can lie. But if you have several people who are all saying basically the same thing, you're going to pause and think, maybe this really happened. Independent eyewitnesses. Now, if your three family members, if they all said that she, what's your name?
Lydia.
Lydia. Okay, Lydia. If they said Lydia, if they all three said Lydia ate this, but all three of them told the story in slightly different ways, that would let us know that they hadn't collaborated on this story. You see, if on a witness stand, three different people get up and they word for word tell the exact same story, what are you going to think if they do that? Huh? Okay, that they're lying because they've gotten together, haven't they? And they've basically memorized the same story. But independent witnesses is when multiple people report the same facts, but in the reporting of those same facts, those three different people or however many it may be, that in the reporting of that, they tell the story slightly differently, emphasizing different things. Maybe even having a few things just slightly different where there's kind of some rough edges in fitting those stories together. Then you're going to say, you know what, they haven't collaborated on this. They're telling something that they really saw, independent eyewitnesses. But not just independent, but eyewitnesses with nothing to gain if they fabricate their testimony. Nothing to gain. Now, if this was a court case in which Lydia was going to be taken to jail over something and her three family members are all telling a similar story on this, we could say, you know what, they may just be trying to keep Lydia out of jail. Maybe they're telling a story on that, or maybe if for some reason Lydia's at odds with them, maybe they're trying to get her into jail, one or the other, whichever one it may be. But they may be doing one or the other, but they've got something that they want to gain out of it. But what if somebody tells a story and all that's going to happen to them is death and hardship and pain for telling that story? What about that? What about people that have nothing to gain if they fabricate their testimony? What about that? There's another one. Testimony recorded while the eyewitnesses are still alive. Testimony recorded while eyewitnesses are still alive. If that receipt was printed later for that, you're going to question that. But that receipt has a date on it that was within the past 24 hours. Or that somebody wrote this out on their blog, what you ate at lunch, they wrote this out on their blog yesterday at some point and there's a timestamp on it. Or however it may be, that it was written in the lifetimes of the eyewitnesses so that people who were really there and saw it could, if they needed to, say, no, I was there, I saw this, and it didn't happen that way. So testimony written in the lifetimes of the eyewitnesses. Now, none of these are foolproof. You see, history, by its very nature, is not science. You can't have where you replicate this somehow and get a 100% proof positive answer. Sometimes people expect scientific type of certainty with history. But history isn't that way. History is all about probabilities. And when you have all of these probabilities in place, you make the valid assumption, based on the evidence, that this event really occurred. And it not only works for you eating lunch yesterday, it works for the Civil War, the Revolutionary War, it works for all of these things that are in the past. They're past, they're gone. But we believe that they happened based on the evidence that we have, and we do so wisely. It's wise to do that. We do this in all of our relationships. The fact is, you can't prove, when you got up this morning, you could not prove in any way, just immediately at least, it would be difficult for you to prove your birth date, for example. You can't prove your birth date. You cannot prove your birth date. Because, yeah, there's a record of it, but are records ever fabricated sometimes? Has your mom ever lied? Has your dad ever lied? Has a doctor ever lied? You can't absolutely prove the day you were born. But when your birthday rolls around, you will celebrate your birthday. You have faith that it really happened. You have faith that, why? You have multiple eyewitnesses. You have independent eyewitnesses. You have eyewitnesses with nothing to gain if they fabricate your testimony, and testimony like birth certificates and things like that, that were recorded while eyewitnesses were still around. We live this way all the time. This is how we determined what happened in the past. Now, Alexander the Great, I'm sure you've looked at him at some level in history, and I use him because he's a major king. He's a major ruler in this. And I want you to think about for just a moment who Alexander the Great really was, just in case you've forgotten that part. 4th century BC, he rules a kingdom that stretched all the way from Europe to Persia. That's a large swath of territory, okay? He had just ruled this massive territory, Alexander the Great did. He was widely known all across the world during his lifetime. And not one of your history textbooks would doubt that he really conquered this whole territory, that he really existed, and that the basic facts of his life are pretty well known. Nobody in your history class has ever said, you know what, I'm just a skeptic about Alexander. I'm just not sure the guy existed. I don't even know. Maybe he didn't exist. Not one person with an ounce of brains in their head is going to say, I don't think Alexander existed. But I want us to look carefully at some things about Alexander the Great and about Jesus. Let's first look at Alexander the Great. Did you know that not one biography of Alexander the Great survives that was written in his lifetime? Not one. There were five written in his lifetime, or soon after his lifetime, during the times of eyewitnesses, and there were two written after, not too long after. So there are five written during the lifetimes of eyewitnesses, two written soon afterwards, and not one of those seven biographies survives. Not even one of them. Seven biographies written close to the time of the eyewitnesses, five written during the lifetimes of eyewitnesses, not one survives. Not one. Not even one. Not only that, the people who wrote these biographies, they had something to gain from it. Callisthenes, he was the official biographer of Alexander the Great until he fell out of favor with Alexander and got and ended up crucified. But there's one of these accounts that got up to that point, and he had everything to gain from it. The others were officers with Alexander the Great and had everything to gain by what they wrote as well. In fact, there are only five accounts of Alexander the Great that survive, and the earliest one comes from 600 years after his life. 600 years. Six centuries passed between Alexander's life and the earliest account that survives of his life. All the others have been lost. But here's what's even more interesting on this. You'd think that all over the ancient world there would be surviving these little inscriptions, you know, or maybe, you know, things in trees, Alexander, or carved in a tree or in a stone or something, or some sort of monument to him. There are five in the entire ancient world. Five. Five inscriptions mentioning Alexander the Great in his lifetime, simply mentioning that he existed and that he was there. That's it. That's all we've got for Alexander the Great. That's all we have. Now let's switch over and take these same standards and apply them to the life of Jesus, and then specifically we'll look at the resurrection of Jesus. Let's move over to those. Let's grab your Bibles. I had you turn to 1 Corinthians. We'll get to it in a little bit. But I just want you to think about the table of contents in your Bible. Just the table of contents. Now, Jesus was an obscure Jewish teacher, never traveled outside the provinces of Judea, Samaria, Decapolis, and Galilee, and yet within 40 years of his death, three complete biographies are in circulation, maybe four. Three complete biographies, maybe four. Two of those early ones and the one that comes later can be traced directly to eyewitnesses. They can be traced directly to eyewitnesses. Matthew walked and talked with Jesus. Matthew was with Jesus. Mark, do you know where the Gospel of Mark comes from? Peter, good. But Peter, it comes from Simon Peter. The Gospel of Mark, Simon Peter traveled all over the ancient world with Mark. And Mark translated Simon Peter's stories from Aramaic into Greek, because Simon Peter never really caught on to speaking cultured Greek, we would suppose. And so Mark translated these, and after doing this year after year after year, Mark memorized the stories. This is testified all the way back to the earliest stages that this is exactly how Mark's gospel comes to be. So when you read Mark's gospel, you are reading the stories from the Apostle Peter. That's who you're reading. Luke, not a direct eyewitness, though he talked to eyewitnesses according to his account. John's gospel comes from an eyewitness account. So within the time of the lifespans of the eyewitnesses, you have all of these gospels emerging in the lifetimes of eyewitnesses. In the lifetimes of the eyewitnesses. Now, in the same time span that Alexander the Great, all he has surviving is five inscriptions. Okay? That's all he's got. In that same time span, do you know how many fragments or full documents about Jesus we have in terms of copies? About 5,300. There are about 5,300 copies of some portion of the New Testament that are in circulation within that same 600-year time span. If we were to count from Alexander the Great to his first biography, count from Jesus 600 years forward, and what you end up with somewhere around 5,000 fragments or full manuscripts of texts about Jesus. I want us to just kind of think through that deeply and carefully. So look at the timeline right here. If we look at this as a timeline, in the year 30, Jesus is crucified. Already by the year 49, you've got a letter going out from Paul about that speaks of the risen Jesus. First letter to the Corinthians by the year 55. All Paul's letters fall somewhere in this range before the mid-60s. By the mid-60s, you have Mark's gospel. But somewhere between 70 and 90, Luke's and Matthew's gospel. We have 70 to 100, somewhere in that range there, John's gospel. How long is it between Alexander the Great and the first biography we have of him? How long is it? 600 years. How long is it between Jesus and the first biography? About 30 years. Yet, we would want, in many cases, people would want to say, oh, sure, Alexander the Great conquered the whole world. And I think he did. I'm not trying to make you a skeptic about Alexander the Great. What I want you to see is that if we apply the same standards to Jesus that we apply to other ancient historical figures, that we must accept that Jesus really was who he said he was. If we simply apply the same standards to Jesus that we apply to others. Because we have clear evidence. This is a guy that was born in the first century, writes this in the early second century, a man named Papias. And he says, Mark, Peter's interpreter, wrote accurately as much as he remembered, though not in ordered form, of the Lord's sayings and doings. Matthew, in the Hebrew dialect, it's a little uncertain what that means, placed sayings in an orderly arrangement. So we've got Matthew and Mark right there testified that this is where these texts came from. And how this is 70, 80 years after the time of Jesus, that these texts are well known, widely known, and being written about. Another example from Polycarp. He's born in the first century, and he's reported through a guy named Irenaeus later on. Matthew composed his gospel, tells about that. Mark, Peter's follower interpreter, same story that Papias had told, handed down to us Peter's proclamation. And then he speaks of Luke, and he speaks of John.
In other words, these were known to have come from eyewitnesses. Another little fragment, middle of the second century, so a little over 100 years after the time of Jesus, speaks of the third book of the gospel being Luke, the fourth one being John. It speaks of those and where they came from as well. It speaks of those. Very clearly, letting us know from ancient documents that still exist, copies of them still exist, the integrity of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now I want to look at one specific thing, and that's what we're going to look at 1 Corinthians chapter 15. One specific thing to help you see the most important part, which is, of course, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So we have here in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, he speaks first of, I would have you know, brothers, and he speaks of the gospel and begins. And then he says in verse 3, so chapter 15, verse 3, he says, I handed down to you in the first thing, as of first importance, that which I had received. Now, first off, when Paul says, I passed on to you that which I had received, Paul is marking that as what was called an oral tradition. And I can't get into all the details of that, but this meant that this was a story that had been passed down unchanged and had been passed from person to person to person to person. So when you read 1 Corinthians 15, you're reading something that goes all the way back to the time soon after Jesus' death that they were using to summarize the gospel story. That's why it's really important in that. I passed on to you what I also received, that Christ was suffered for our sins, according to the scriptures. And then he speaks of how Jesus was raised from the dead on the third day. And then he lists a bunch of witnesses. Remember how we were going to figure out what you ate yesterday? He's doing the same thing. He's listing a bunch of witnesses who actually saw this. And he starts with Simon Peter, but he calls him Cephas because this is probably comes from the Aramaic language, so he's using that. And then to the 12, and then he lists all of these witnesses that he says you can, and he speaks to them about how some of these have died, of those hundreds who had seen him, but some of them are still alive. Remember that other standard we talked about? Are the eyewitnesses still alive? You can go talk to them about it. You can go ask them about it. Now, as we look at the accounts of Jesus' resurrection, I want you to look at this kind of this chart I've made here, because this kind of summarizes a lot of different things about this. You've got this from Paul that comes probably as an oral history passed person to person in the early 30s. He writes it down in 55. Notice the different things he has. Crucifixion, Jesus raised on the third day, many people saw him alive. All right? That's the account Paul gives right there. You've got Mark 16. I'll give the skeptic the benefit of the doubt and count that as one witness. Matthew, Mark, Luke, all as one witness instead of counting it as three. Written between 65 and 69, and you got crucifixion, resurrection on the third day, and Mary Magdalene as the first witness. Now you notice we're talking about to Lydia over here about when I said about that it doesn't agree exactly, but it agrees in crucial details, but there's differences, okay, between them. You've got different accounts here. 1 Corinthians and Mark don't tell it in the same words. They tell it in slightly different words. But there's little details that match. Resurrection on the third day. And notice this one about Mary Magdalene. Nobody in the ancient world will make up that. Because a woman did not have status in law courts. She could not testify in a law court at all if she was in a Jewish court. She only could under particular circumstances in a Roman court. If you're going to fabricate this, if you're going to make this up, you would not make up a woman as first witness. But it's there in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's there. But then look at John. John is totally different. Have you ever read John alongside these others? John reads very, very different. Now, he reports the same facts, doesn't he? But he says it very, very differently than the others. In fact, there's almost no parallel between the wording in John and the wording in the other Gospels. And we might think, oh, does this mean that they can't? No, it's actually a good thing. Remember we talked about in a court of law, three people get up and say word for word the same thing, you're going to be suspicious?
In the same way, if all the Gospels were word for word the same, you might be suspicious. Or at least you'd know, as we do with Matthew, Mark, and Luke, that they influenced one another. But John's totally not influenced by any of them. He writes his own thing, writes it in his own way, but he has resurrection on the third day, and that odd little fact that you're not going to make up, Mary Magdalene as witness number one. Now I'm going to skip down to this last one. This one here is a third century, quite a bit later. There's a little fragment called Papyrus Cairo 10759. Some people call it Gospel of Peter, which isn't really accurate. But it's a papyrus. It's not in the New Testament. It doesn't belong in the New Testament. But it's really important because it's not influenced by John and it's not influenced by Matthew, Mark, or Luke. It's totally independent of all of them. And it comes a little bit later, but probably was based on an early tradition of some sort from the church. And amazingly, you have crucifixion, resurrection on the third day, Mary Magdalene as first witness. And what do the witnesses that are writing these things have to gain if they make this up? They have nothing to gain, do they? They have nothing to gain. In fact, they have everything to lose. Simon Peter crucified, probably upside down for his faith, because he continues to testify to it. Some of the other apostles as well went through gruesome deaths, according to many reports. Paul claimed to have seen the risen Lord Jesus on the road to Damascus. He is beheaded. He loses everything for it. They have nothing to gain by this. And these are people who would have known if it was being made up. Simon Peter would know if this was being fabricated. He has nothing to gain. So you remember our standards we talked about? Are there multiple eyewitnesses? Yeah. Are there independent eyewitnesses? They tell the same story, but in their own way that's slightly different. Yeah. Are there witnesses with nothing to gain by making it up? Yeah. Yeah. And are there the eyewitnesses still alive when the story begins to circulate? Yes. Yes. Because of that, we can say with a high level of certainty that I'm not just believing in Jesus and in his resurrection because it makes me feel better, because it's fun, because I have a great youth group, whatever it may be, or because my mom and dad told me to believe this. You can say with confidence that you believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ because it meets every standard that history would place on the occurrence of a historical event. You can say that with confidence. It meets the standards. Now, somebody may choose not to believe that. They may choose to believe that. But whatever it is, you cannot be regarded as ridiculous, deluded, brainwashed, because you believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. It's history. It's looking at history. It's looking at the witnesses of history and embracing the testimony that they have to give to us. The testimony about Jesus was copied accurately. We don't have time to get into that today. It was formulated soon after his death and circulated reliably. It was connected to eyewitnesses, and there were independent testimonies to it. Anything you would look for in history, it is there in the resurrection, particularly of Jesus Christ. It's there. All right, does anybody have any questions? I want to give you a chance just to think about that before I actually ask. But I did put on the bottom of three different seats some sticky notes with smiley faces on them. And so if you could find sticky notes with smiley faces under your seat, so I'll give you just a few minutes to be searching for that. Does anybody have any? Found one? Okay, great. There you go. Get a free book. All right. Anybody else? Anybody else? All right, you got one. All right, awesome. Anybody else have one? Should be a yellow or orangish sticker under your seat. Look at that.
Yeah, so should be one other. There's one other one somewhere. So anyway. And once you get up, you can. And so free book, the latest book I've written, this one on the end times, you can grab if you've got the yellow sticker that that requires. Anybody have any questions or anything like that? Anybody? Yes.
Mm-hmm. In the place, the region that Jesus was and his witnesses were, they were probably far less educated than the people that Alexander the Great was around, which means his testimony may have a little more merit just based on that alone, and because his conquest was far more broad than the scale of Jesus, you know, even though after his death, obviously, it spread like wildfire.
Right.
But what would you say to someone who raised the argument of, well, he covered a lot more ground, and therefore his testimony makes a lot more sense?
To the person who says that Alexander conquered all the world and therefore his testimony makes more sense, I would say in some sense you're correct in that. Yeah, it's more believable, but it's only believable if we assume there is no God. In other words, if somebody's arguing that they're in essence including their conclusion, it's a circular argument because they're including their conclusion, their assumption, in their premises at that point. So in other words, they're saying that it's unbelievable to believe that somebody really rose from the dead, but it is believable to believe somebody took over the world. Therefore, we should. But somebody rising from the dead is only unbelievable if you go into it assuming there is no God. It's a circular argument that they're making at that point. And in that, it's really important that, because you hear that a lot. I mean, I hear that all the time. That type of an argument, we have to leave the, if we're arguing for a particular or against something divine, then we have to leave the options both open, that there may or may not be, and not bias it by saying, well, this is more believable. Because ultimately, what they mean when they say it's more believable that somebody took over the world is, I've seen this happen I've witnessed this, but this one I haven't. And then I think the other side of that is, there's almost an assumption that the people in Jesus's day were stupid and didn't understand that people really rise, that people didn't understand that people don't rise from the dead. Well, the people then knew that if you're dead, you stay dead. They knew that. They know that. They're fully aware of that. And so I think that's another aspect of it too, that they found that even more, they found that just as unbelievable as we do, that somebody would be raised from the dead. And in some sense, the fact that you would then put your life on the line saying something like that, saying Alexander the Great conquered the world, that's not something that requires it's like, okay, I'm not putting my life on the line to assert that when I say that. When I say that Jesus rose from the dead, that is a radical and ridiculous claim. So in my opinion, it actually turns against because of the fact that one is more believable than the other. Because the fact that people would, on a widespread basis, record testimony that is patently so ridiculous. It really, in some ways, is from any human perspective, and they knew it was too. But yet they're willing to put their life on the line for it, makes it more believable rather than less, unless you presume a non-supernatural universe going into it. But then you're not really coming in unbiased. You're coming in with a bias saying, I'm going to assume that the supernatural can't occur and argue from that basis. Well, you've already assumed your conclusion in your methodology at that point. Yeah, good question. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. By definition, miracles rarely happen. Right. Therefore, the
Right, it is the exact same thing. And what he's making is the assumption of David Hume, so is a philosopher, David Hume. Basically, that just comes straight from David Hume. I mean, it really, that's what it is. It's that you have to assume the most probable, but ultimately most probable ends up, what have I experienced on that? What is normal human experience? And even by that, it really doesn't work because, frankly, some of the military campaigns that have happened have been highly improbable. So we don't do history on the basis of the plausibility of whether we think this could occur. We go for it on the basis of what is the evidence of what did occur. And what they're really doing is making a shift from looking at the evidence to looking at plausibility based on experience. That's really what they're doing. And it's saying, I will not go where the evidence leads.
because the evidence leads somewhere that requires something that I view as implausible or unlikely. And so they're choosing plausibility over actual evidence. What I'm saying is take the evidence. Take the evidence and take wherever the evidence leads. If the evidence leads away from faith, then see where that goes. Take it, run with it. But if the evidence leads toward, go with where the evidence actually leads rather than where plausibility would take you. Yeah. Any other questions? Anyone? Yes.
You said you don't really have time to get into how the scripture was copied.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, it's a huge discussion, mm-hmm. textual criticism. But do you have like a 2-minute version of that you can use to mm-hmm. actually share the gospel?
Yeah. If somebody raises that question, first off, if I'm actually sharing the gospel at that moment, I'm going to say, well, let's look at just the text about the crucifixion and resurrection. And let's look at, do they differ in any ways that call that into question? Again, I'm not going to try to argue the textual criticism of the whole Bible if I'm sharing the gospel with somebody. I'm going to go straight for just the cross and the empty tomb. And then we'll work out the rest later. And so that's the first level of the answer. Second level would be that when people start talking about all these changes in this, not one change affects anything that we believe about Jesus Christ. There are about a half dozen chunks that are not in some manuscripts of the New Testament and so on like that, that are significant pieces of it, but not one of them affects anything that we believe about Jesus. So you've got, you got Matthew 16, 9 through 20 that lists some of the actual witnesses to the resurrection and so on like that. That was added in later on. The Gospel of Mark ends at verse 8. But the resurrection is still there if you just ended at verse 8. You've got, for example, John 7, 53 through 8, 11, which appears in Luke in some manuscripts. It appears in John, or it doesn't appear at all. I mean, that one is that's the story of the woman caught in adultery. But again, we aren't doing any of our theology about who Jesus was based on that text. It's this great story, but we're not developing what we believe about Jesus from that text. So to let people know, there's not one of these changes that has occurred over the centuries that affects anything we believe about Jesus. And so that would be where I would say to leave it at that point. And if they say, well, I read about this, then say, show me, let's look at it. They might pull something out and you say, you know what, but let's say they come up with, there's a section in 1 John that says, the Father, the Word, and the Spirit bear witness, and it's a clear testimony to the Trinity right there. That was added in later. It wasn't in the original manuscripts. You can say, you know what, that doesn't appear in some manuscripts, but do you know what the Trinity is in Matthew 28? It says, in the name, singular, of the Father, Son, and Spirit, three. That's pretty clear right there. That's one and yet three, so that's there. So we were not, in other words, the doctrine of the Trinity isn't built on that text. And so to help people see that any of these changes don't affect what we believe about Jesus. So that would be the kind of the two levels of that. Yes, so somebody over here, yeah. Yes, yeah.
Two very quick questions that are easy to answer. One, I know you started this a lot, so what is the time period that we're looking at for Alexander the Great's conquest?
4th century BC at that point, yeah.
And also, obviously the people that we're dealing with, as far as the testimonies go, they're going to be a little different. So as far as the cultural advancement, were they about at par with each other, reading and writing capabilities, things like that, and communication?
Those with Alexander the Great would actually have been higher than those with Jesus. So once again, that we would expect more out of them because he had people who were readers and writers around him, whereas Jesus, it was a far lower level of literacy. And yet, even with a lower level of literacy, we end up with multiple testimonies independent in the lifetime of the eyewitnesses, even in an area of the Levant there, where they had a much lower level of literacy than the entourage with Alexander the Great. So, yeah.
Thank you.